Okay, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We'll begin. We have with us today two members of the Commission of Inquiry on the Situation of Human Rights in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Mr. Michael Kirby, the chairperson, is a former justice of the High Court of Australia, former president of the International Commission of Jurists, and was also special representative of the UN Secretary General for Human Rights in Cambodia between 1994 and 1996. Also with us is Ms. Sonia Biserko. She is the founder and president of the Helsinki Committee for Human Rights in Serbia and has written extensively on the wars in former Yugoslavia. She is also a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. The third member of the commission, Mr. Marzuki Darusman, the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Democratic Republic, People's Republic of Korea, unfortunately could not be with us today. The Commission of Inquiry was established by the Human Rights Council in March of this year with a mandate to investigate the systematic, widespread, and grave violations of human rights in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Mr. Kirby will make brief remarks, and then our two colleagues will take some questions. Mr. Kirby, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming to this media briefing. For me, it is a return to the media conference that follows an appearance before the Third Committee of the General Assembly of the United Nations, because back in 1993, when I was appointed the Special Representative of the Secretary General for Human Rights in Cambodia, I presented my reports to the Third Committee over the 3 years that I held that mandate, and then submitted myself to the questions at a media conference thereafter. So it's like a return to my earlier life, and the challenges of human rights have not become easier in the intervening 20 years. The purpose of today was for the members of the Commission of Inquiry to provide an oral update to the General Assembly of the United Nations. This was a requirement that was expressed in the mandate that we received from the Human Rights Council of the United Nations. A month ago, I delivered a similar oral update to the Council on Human Rights, and many of the comments that were received at the session today were similar to those that were received in Geneva at the time of the oral update to the Human Rights Council. Distinguished representative of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, contended that the Commission of Inquiry was a hostile act, that it was established with a propensity to listen to hostile witnesses who were not to be believed, and that the members of the Commission of Inquiry were being deceived by them insofar as they believed their testimony. The contention of a number of countries was to the effect that the Commission of Inquiry was the wrong way to go about human rights violations, that the right way to go about it was by quiet consultation and discussion, and not to have country-specific mandates such as the one on the Democratic People's Republic of Korea that has led to the office of the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in North Korea, Mr. Darusman, and the Commission of Inquiry, which comprises Mr. Darusman, Ms. Berserko, and myself, that this is the wrong way about human rights, and that it would be better to just have either thematic examination of issues or discussion and engagement with the countries concerned. The fact is that the members of the Commission of Inquiry are not biased against North Korea. On the contrary, throughout our mandate, from the very beginning, We have reached out to the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. We have asked for the permission to go and visit North Korea, to engage with its people. We have pointed out that the best way to respond to the contention that testimony which has been recorded in our public hearings is false would be to open those parts of North Korea which are said to contain the detention and prison camps of which the witnesses before us give copious evidence. To the accusation that we have defamed the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the answer comes back that the answer to any defamation, as everyone in this room would, I hope, know, is that the statements made are true. And therefore, the one way to establish whether truth is told or not would be to open the borders, allow free media access to the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, and also to allow the Commission of Inquiry to go there, interview people, go to the places that have been identified by the witnesses and report them to the United Nations and to the general world community. As to the contention by the number of the countries which were critical of the Commission of Inquiry and of the Special Rapporteur that there should be engagement and dialogue, you can't have dialogue on your own. To have a dialogue, you have to have interaction with those with whom you're dialoguing. We have reached out, we've asked for dialogue. We have asked the representatives of North Korea to come to our public hearings. We've asked for them to send a representative who could, with the consent of the Commission of Inquiry, ask questions of the witnesses and also who could make a statement putting forward their propositions on the effect of the witnesses' evidence, whether it should be believed, and if it should not be believed, why it should not be believed, and who would have the facility of calling witnesses themselves to contradict the testimony that we have been receiving. It is important to say that the approach of having public hearings is not the normal practice of commissions of inquiry. However, it is a practice that is particularly well suited to the investigation of human rights abuses that are contended in North Korea, because it not only permits the persons who come forward and give their testimony to be interrogated, questioned, and then have their testimony put online and make it available to the whole international community so that people everywhere in the world where the internet is, and that does not include North Korea, because in North Korea access to the internet is basically confined to an elite, for people having access to their testimony to judge for themselves. You don't have to accept my view or that of Commissioner Berserker or the Commission of Inquiry about the evidence that we've been receiving. You can judge for yourselves. You can have access to the testimony. There was testimony taken in London last week, and very shortly, if not already, that will be online as well. And likewise, the testimony in Washington, where we're going later tonight in order to take evidence and have consultations later in this week. In addition to that, the testimony permits us to be judged. We are ourselves under scrutiny, both in the manner in which we've conducted the inquiry, in the fairness of the procedures which we have observed, and the fairness of the questioning. We have made it a point not to put words into the mouths of the witnesses, but to allow them to tell their own stories so that they will be the more believable and can be assessed more easily, because these are the stories of people from North Korea who have left that country and come elsewhere in order to have a better, happier and more human rights respecting life. anything that we say today is subject to the ongoing deliberations of the Commission of Inquiry. We will be concluding our public hearings and investigations with the sessions in Washington, D.C. There will be one further field visit to Seoul in Korea for the purpose of wrapping up a number of witnesses. But once that is finished, it is likely that there will be no further investigation, and we will then settle into the analysis phase. The analysis phase should begin on or shortly after the 1st of November, when we conclude in Washington, D.C. That will be the subject of engagement by the members of the Commission of Inquiry and also by our hard-working secretariat based in Geneva. The analysis period will then be concluded in about a month, a little bit more than a month, at which stage the consideration and deliberation and decision-making of the Commission of Inquiry will commence early in December. That will be concluded by the writing of the report in which the commissioners and the secretariat will be engaged. Effectively, because the report has to be given to the Human Rights Council by March of 2014, it has to be written in January 2014. And it will be completed so that it can be translated into the United Nations languages and then delivered by me to the Human Rights Council in the presence of my colleagues on the Commission of Inquiry and the Secretariat in March of 2014 in accordance with our mandate. At that stage, it is expected that the Commission of Inquiry, having concluded its mandate, will hand matters back to the Special Rapporteur so that the follow-up of the conclusions, findings and recommendations of the Commission of Inquiry can be placed back in the hands of the Special Rapporteur. I should say that Mr. Durrisman, before he left to return to his home in Indonesia, asked me to express his regrets for not being able to be at this media conference. He isn't at all well, and he would have stayed if he had been able to do so, but he has to return home and seek medical treatment because he's not well. And that's why the procedures were adopted this morning of having his report read by a member of the Secretariat. But he was there during the reading of the report, and he concurred in the answers that I gave on behalf both of his mandate and of the mandate of the three of us as the members of the Commission of Inquiry. So that is my opening statement, and both Commissioner Berserko and I will be very happy to answer questions. I'd ask you just to identify who you are and where you come from so that we know something, and then we will endeavour to answer the questions that are put to us.
Please.
Good afternoon, Evelyn Leopold. I welcome you on behalf of the United Nations Correspondent Association. And my question is, you have already commented on large-scale abuse, on unspeakable atrocities. Would your final report reflect anything milder than that, or does one expect that when you write this in December, you will continue to condemn what you have heard from witnesses?
Well, first of all, thank you for being here and thank you for your question. And I apologize that I sat in your seat. That was a mistake on my part. Apparently, that is a holy seat. And that showed my lack of familiarity or that I'd forgotten over 20 years the protocol of the room. Secondly, we will cover faithfully and honestly and succinctly the testimony that we have received. Some of the testimony has been extremely distressing. Testimony concerning the detention facilities, the lack of proper food in them, the fact that people in the detention facilities who have committed no offence and no crime according to their testimony, but who are simply there because of the notion of intergenerational guilt, which is a feature of the system in North Korea. As well as that, the stories of abductions, abductions of young people from Japan, but similarly, abduction of soldiers during the Korean War 60 years ago, and the still waiting relatives who only ask that they be informed of what happened to their loved ones and given the opportunity, if they are dead, to pay respects to their remains, as is the tradition in Korea as elsewhere. The stories of great suffering during the famine in 1994 to 7, and the ongoing serious problem of neonatal stunting. The UNICEF report, which I referred to in my oral update this morning, indicates that the of the babies born in North Korea, even today, 27.9% are stunted. We know enough about the problem of stunting in neonates as a result of the European babies who were stunted in the last year of the Second World War to know that they carry with them health burdens that last all their lives, and that there is an advance of dementia in stunted babies. So it is not a good development, and it is one which is a reproach to those who have the authority and power over the provision of food in North Korea. So there are many things that are distressing. I am a judge of 35 years' experience, and I've seen in that time a lot of melancholy court cases which somewhat harden one's heart. But even in my own case, there have been a number of the testimonies which have moved me to tears, and I'm not ashamed to say that. You would have to be a stony-hearted person not to be moved by the stories that the Commission of Inquiry has received. Those stories are online. They are supported by online provision of the transcript of the testimony in Korean and in the English language, and in the Japanese case in Japanese as well, so that they are there for the world to see, for the countries in this building representing in the United Nations to see, and they should be seen, and they should be considered for the follow-up that will be required. I should only like to add one thing. Women figure very greatly in the testimony that we have received. Women are the majority of those nationals of North Korea who have sought to exercise a right guaranteed to them by international law to leave the country, and many of them have left and gone into China, where they are subject to forced marriages, trafficking, and other human rights burdens. When they are returned to North Korea, they are invariably dealt with for the offence under North Korean law that is involved in leaving the country, and they have suffered very grievously, and their testimony is also online. And the treatment of women, as exposed in the evidence, is a very serious problem, and it will require reflection and ultimately a full report by the Commission of Inquiry. I don't know if Commissioner Berserko wishes to add anything about that aspect of the matter.
Well, I can only add that this is one of the issues that hasn't been caught by media attention. So far, prison camps and famine were well known over the years, but women's position, I would say, maybe was less focused on, and I think it should be at least at this point taken high on the agenda, because it's not only that they suffer in North Korea itself, but also as refugees in China and other neighboring countries. And about 80% of refugees are women. And not that only they undergo tough experiences, they very often have to accept to be trafficked and sold to Chinese men because they don't want to return. But once caught by Chinese and sent back home, they undergo severe punishments, either going sent to prisons or kept in detention centers and treated in a most horrible way. And also during the famine years, the burden of feeding the families was mostly on the women. They, for the first time, they were allowed to work, mostly women about 50, who were able to organize some small business or and marketing developed, but only on the survival level. So I think the burden of North Korean women is enormous and should really be more investigated and more in the attention of the media.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Yasusawa from Kyodo News. That is Japan's newswire service. Thank you for coming today. My question is the concrete action that international community will take that you referred to in the last part of your statement today. So you said the international community will have to face its obligation and will decide what concrete action to take. But my question is, what do you think? What kind of international communities' concrete action would be effective to change this situation? Because the DPRK has been defying to any kind of call from the international community. They defied to the resolution of the General Assembly. They defied to the report of the Special Rapporteur, and they defied to even to the Security Council resolution. So I would be grateful if you could give us your view to how to change, what kind of international community's action would change the situation.
Both in Geneva and also today here in New York, the representatives of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea contended that the Commission of Inquiry and the Special Rapporteur were part of hostile acts designed to achieve regime change in North Korea. Now, that is something which neither the Special Rapporteur nor the Commission of Inquiry have ever considered or addressed. What a presumption it would be of bodies of the United Nations to purport to usurp the prerogative that belongs to the people of Korea. They have a complete right under the principles of the United Nations to determine their own government, and it would not be a correct step for the organs of the United Nations or its representatives to intrude upon such a matter. So we deny it, and we have not done so. And starting from that proposition, it's important to at least approach the solution to the problem, not by further name-calling and insulting, but by a faithful and honest report of what we have found, but also by reaching out to and endeavouring to influence for the good the treatment of the people of North Korea and respect for their human rights. As I indicated in my statement to the Third Committee of the General Assembly, when in Cambodia, after the terrible genocides and suffering that had existed in the Cambodian nation in the 1980s and 90s, the United Nations moved to Cambodia, the steps were taken to establish in situ, in Phnom Penh, an Office of Human Rights. And that was available both to monitor human rights developments in the country, but also to provide technical assistance and advice and support to the government of the country. So that one matter which we have to consider is whether that solution, which has been tried elsewhere and is under consideration in this House at the moment, in another country which has had a similar isolation from the international community, would work in North Korea, whether it would be consented to by the government of North Korea, whether it would be effective in the environment of North Korea, and if refused, whether some alternative Office of Human Rights for North Korea could be contemplated to be situated in another country close by. So that there are a number of practical considerations that will be assessed by the Commission of Inquiry. It's premature for me to identify what all of them will be, but one which I do not think will be available is the idea that the Commission of Inquiry will just go on forever as another mandate of the United Nations, because that, in a sense, lets the member states off the hook. It encourages them to think that by creating the Commission of Inquiry, it has solved the problem of North Korea, which it has not. And therefore, we have endeavoured to discourage the thought that the Commission of Inquiry on North Korea should become a permanent organ. We think it should complete its mission, it should report faithfully and truthfully, it should make findings, it should express its conclusions and make some recommendations. And then it will be a matter for the international community to take the responsibility where it belongs. A Commission of Inquiry proposes, but ultimately it's politicians, it's the political representatives of the member states of the United Nations who dispose. And they have to avoid the thought that they can postpone the consideration of the grave violations of human rights, which have already come to the notice of the Commission of Inquiry, and simply allow this matter to bubble away indefinitely. That should not be permitted. And when we deliver our report, it would be my hope that in this House there will be a concerted resolve to find a way to ensure that what has become intolerable to the international community will be addressed resolutely, firmly and effectively, but with respect to the status of the Democratic People's Republic as a member country of the United Nations.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Something is wrong with the microphone. It's not our fault, though. My name is Errol Abdovich. I do represent the Republican Anatolia Press Agency. I really was following what you have just said, but with all due respect, when we hear that kind of words, we have heard it so many times here at the United Nations. When you say resolutely to address this issue, what do you really mean by that? And who would do that? You call up on politicians, but what politicians can do with the North Korea? Thank you.
Well, one thing you will not have heard often in this House, I suggest to you, is a mandate holder saying that they should be terminated. Many mandate holders believe that the mandate should go on indefinitely until the resolution is found. But we think that that is not a good thought to have in your mind. We think that we should discharge our mandate, return the general obligations of reportage to the special rapporteur and fade from the picture, because we don't think we should become an excuse for doing nothing. Now, at this stage, we haven't completed our testimony and receiving evidence. We'll be doing that at the end of this week. Then we will analyse that testimony. Then we will consider what can be done. And it's at that stage we will consider all the options that are on the table. I simply do not accept that nothing can be done. I don't believe that that is a proper approach, and I don't believe that would do justice to the people of North Korea. if, as we ultimately conclude, they have been subject to really serious and grave violations of their human rights, which are continuing. And therefore, what should be done will be the subject of our recommendations, but essentially it's the same in our member countries of the United Nations. Commissions of inquiry don't have available to them blue helmets. We don't have a posse that we can set upon to resolve the matter by force of arms or in any other way. That is not available. And therefore, we have to think of other means. Those other means won't involve simply calumny and insult. They will involve continuing to endeavour to reach out to North Korea, to the friends of North Korea, to the neighbours of North Korea, which have an interest in the safety of the environment of their region. And by doing this, to secure steps in the direction of change. I saw steps in the direction of change in Cambodia. The position is not completely analogous because Cambodia had gone through the UNTAC period and Cambodia allowed the special representative into the country and engaged with the civil society and so on. So it's not a complete analogy, but I would express the view that we should not accept that nothing can be done, because the history of humanity is of a constant progress since 1945, when this organisation, the United Nations, was established, and when in its charter it established peace and security, economic equity and universal human rights as the three central pillars of the organisation. So that it's a matter of concluding our work, expressing our recommendations, but then the responsibility will lie where it should. And if that involves repeating what earlier mandate holders have said, well, so be it, because that is both the political reality and the legal role of the institutions in the organisation. We investigate, we inquire, we report, but we do not finally determine what should be done. That has to be done with political accountability.
I'm Yoshiaki Kasuga, Japanese newspaper, Asahi Shimbun. My question is, some countries criticize your inquiry, saying it's politically biased or it's a political tool to pressure DPRK. How do you respond to this?
Well, I respond to it as I did during the oral update to the Third Committee of the General Assembly. I reject the contention. Why would I be a political tool of anybody? I've spent 35 years as a judge. Why would I suddenly, at this stage in my life, when I could be out in Australia in the sunshine, take on a responsibility to deal with a very complicated and challenging task? Why would my colleagues do that with their own lives and responsibilities in their homes? It is, in my respectful view, not to be believed that we have simply thrown over a commitment to universal human rights and to the principles of this organisation and taken on a role of hostility to anybody. I have no hostility to North Korea. I am respectful of diversity in our world. I am respectful of countries within the universal principles of human rights having their own social organisation and having the diversity of social organisation which already exists in the world. But that diversity has to be subject to the universal principles of human rights. And our job is simply to measure the testimony we're receiving against those standards. That's something I've been doing for 35 years in my own country, and it's no difficulty doing it once again in respect of North Korea, and doing it with independence, with impartiality, with neutrality, and with respect for the diversity of DPRK.
Sure. Matthew Lee, Inner City Press. I want to thank you on behalf of the Free UN Coalition for Access, both of you, for coming, and to say you should sit anywhere you want. There are no holy seats here. But I did want to say, I wanted to ask you, earlier today, there was one of the rapporteurs, Margaret Sagakia, on defenders of human rights. She had mentioned it's kind of an obverse of something that you said, which is that in South Korea, there's a law, the National Security Act, that prohibits people there from reading anything produced in North Korea, reading tweets from North Korea. All of this information is blocked. It goes back to 1948. And she said there's a problem with that in freedom of expression in terms of South Korea. But I wonder, you seem to be saying that openness would help North Korea, but do you think that their information should be able to be heard by South Korea? And I also, in terms of her mandate, what information have you gleaned in your hearings about, are there in fact even the ability to be human rights defenders in North Korea, and what fate do they find?
Well, the answer to the last question is we have no evidence that there is a right for human rights defenders to operate as such in North Korea. If there were such a right, I believe we would have heard about it, and I would be very surprised if that facility belongs to citizens in North Korea, because it runs completely counter to the testimony which we have received about the nature of their society and the controls that are imposed and the sanctions that are imposed in the event that people do not respect the dominance of the governing party and its representatives in the Korean Workers' Party. So I don't think that exists in North Korea. As to the suggested infractions of the law in the Republic of Korea, South Korea, we have, of course, heard of these complaints. I think it may be in general an area where the actual letter of the law is not always obeyed, as is often the case in vibrant democratic societies. There's plenty of evidence in the Republic of Korea of an energetic civil society and of people saying viewpoints of all kinds, including hostile to the governing party and its institutions. And that has been a feature of South Korea over several decades. So I'm not at all sure that the problem of limitations in the law is a major practical problem in day-to-day life in South Korea. If it is, it should be addressed. Just as if there are problems, as was said by the Chinese representative to the Third Committee today, in countries, he mentioned Canada, but one might also mention my own country, Australia, which have laws, migration laws, against economic migrants. If these breach the universal principles of the Refugees Convention and Protocol, then they should be dealt with by United Nations rapporteurs and agencies, and they should not hold their punches. They should express criticism, and my belief is that they do, sometimes with justification. So that if there is criticism to be made in the Republic of Korea of their laws or of their activities, that should be expressed in a free society and in the international and national media. However, it is not part of our mandate. Our mandate is concerned with the abuses of human rights in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea and connected with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. So our focus is upon the situation of human rights in that country. And that being our mandate, that is what we're going to concentrate on. And can I say, with 8 items in our mandate and a closing paragraph that says, if these 8 are not enough, you can do any other related matter, we're not looking around for extra work outside the mandate. We're concentrating on the mandate we have, and that is plenty of work for us between now and next March when we deliver our report.
Yes, please.
Thank you. My name is Go Kamoshida. I'm from NHK, the Japanese public broadcaster. I have 2 questions. My first question is about your statement this morning. What are the additional part to the your last month's statement in Geneva that you would like to stress most? And the second question is there any more possibility you visit China also to complete your report? Thank you.
I didn't quite get the first question. Would you repeat what are the
additional parts to your statement in Geneva last month? What are the new parts of today's statement compared to last month's statement?
The new parts have not been fully considered by the Commission of Inquiry, and I don't want to foreshadow what might come out of our deliberation. The concept of having a human rights office either in DPRK or in some nearby venue which could be well resourced, which could be a source of advice if that would be listened to, which could collect the stories and analyse the material and information, is something that has worked elsewhere. If you look around the world, the countries which have been successful in transitioning from an autocratic regime to one which is more human rights respecting, that has been done by procedures sometimes that provide advice and assistance, and that at least should be sought. I certainly support the idea, which was advanced, you'll recall, at the Third Committee by the representatives of Cuba, of Venezuela, of the Lao People's Republic and others, that there should be dialogue, interchange and so on. But that requires somebody who's willing to engage in dialogue and to interact. I also support what was said, that there should be universal periodic review, and that is a way to secure progress in human rights by dialogue that arises from that review. However, that can't be referred to with much enthusiasm in the case of DPRK, because DPRK, though it participated in universal periodic review, is still the only country in the whole world that has participated in universal periodic review of human rights, but has not accepted a single recommendation made in relation to the improvement of its own human rights record. So that it's one thing to participate, but the participation and the dialogue has to be genuine. And so far, neither with the Special Rapporteur, nor with the Commission of Inquiry, nor with Universal Periodic Review, has that been a feature of the engagement of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Now, as to China, we have had very courteous and agreeable conversations with the mission of China in Geneva, and I'm still hopeful that China will give agreement to the access by the COI to China, because, first of all, that is the route through which the majority of people who have escaped or have left North Korea depart. They have departed through China. And secondly, China, as a country friendly to the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, as a country whose army was instrumental in the Korean War in defending and supporting the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, and therefore holds a very special place in the life and history and recollection of the people and the government of North Korea, China is part of the solution. And that's why we wish to engage with China. As well as that, China is a very powerful country, a very populous country. It is a permanent member of the Security Council. It is a country which itself is engaging increasingly with universal human rights, which recently itself took part in the Universal Periodic Review. And therefore, China is, I think, in a very good position to be a good influence for respect for human rights in North Korea. That's the way in which we approach the engagement with China, and we're still hoping that that engagement will be fruitful. If it is, then we will pursue it. If it is not, we will have to pursue such other avenues and paths as are available.
Yes, Joseph Klein, Canada Free Press.
Oh, sorry, behind you. And then I'm coming to you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Yong-Yu Shin from Korea Times. I can't hear, I'm sorry. You'll have to get another microphone.
Okay. Yes, thank you. Yong-Yu Shin for the Korea Times. Having seen what you've seen, and heard what you've heard so far, do you think the time frame that was given to you by the mandate over 1 year was an ample time for you to accomplish your mission, which is to investigate the violation with a view to ensuring full accountability? And also, in your final report, will you be naming names, whether it be state apparatus or officials that are in actual violation of human rights and including crimes against humanity?
As to the time frame, one learns in the law that if you allow a lot of time, the time expands and people's loquacity expands, and their dilatoriness and their postponement of action and resolution expands. We found this in Australia when we reduced the time available to lawyers, which often spun out to 2 or 3 days, and we gave them 20 minutes to express their arguments in order to try to get into the highest court. It was amazing how efficient people can be if they've got a limited time and that's what they know they've got. Maybe journalists also know this with their word count. They can do their job more quickly and effectively. We've been working very hard. Our secretariat particularly has been working extremely hard. We have called for submissions and we have turned nobody away who has made the application. We have seen hundreds of people. We have gathered hundreds of written documents. We have had these public hearings with hours and hours of testimony, which are available online. All of that will give us a very good insight into the essential issues that have to be addressed and reported within our mandate. And therefore, I don't think that the time limit of March 2014, though it is very severe in all truth, will prevent us providing a report which is succinct, which is controlled, by the way, by a very severe word count limit anyway, that deals with the issues conceptually and paints the picture with accuracy and fairness. That's what we're there to do. And I don't think the marginal utility of increasing the time would be worth the marginal cost of delaying the attention of the international community to the sorts of matters upon which we will have to report. Now, as to the naming of names, that is a matter which we haven't yet considered. As I said in answer to a question which we were asked today by the government of Japan, the delegate of Japan at the Third Committee, it would be premature to say anything about that matter. It is a serious matter. Certainly, the members of the Commission of Inquiry regard it as a serious matter to charge anybody or anybody by description with a crime against humanity. It is a serious matter. It is not to be done lightly. It is not to be done without ample evidence that provides a proper foundation in evidence and testimony for doing so. Therefore, I think it would be better for us to reach a conclusion that that step is necessary before we consider the naming of names, should that ultimately happen. There does appear in the practice of commissions of inquiry to have developed a practice of the naming of names in the event that conclusions are reached that there have been crimes against humanity or other international crimes, grave international crimes. If that position is reached, then the Commission of Inquiry on North Korea will make its determinations in the light of the practice of the House, and that will be available to us as a precedent, and that will be a precedent which we would then carefully consider. But we are not at that stage yet.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Yeah. Joseph Klein from Canada Free Press. First of all, just to follow up on that point and our question, even if you do not get to the point of naming specific individuals as having, in your view, committed crimes against humanity, would there be the possibility that from the facts that you've compiled and your analysis of the facts, that you could draw certain conclusions of a pattern of state violations of human rights and humanitarian law without getting into specific individuals? Which leads me to the next question, which is, you had indicated in your remarks that you respect the right of the people of North Korea to choose their own government, but doesn't that beg the question? Because that is the problem, that the people of North Korea are presumably subjected to this very severe regime of autocracy and all of the human rights violations that appear to be accompanying that. So isn't there some inherent tension, let's say, between the notion of respecting the right of the North Korean people to choose their own government and therefore not get into what would be viewed as interference with that government and decision, when the government itself is presumably the problem? It's imposing all of these restrictions, and the relationship of that to the whole doctrine of responsibility to protect. Would there be any space in your analysis for discussion of that possible remedy?
Well, first of all, in relation to state agency or other responsibility, certainly in the nature of governmental and official organisation in North Korea, and in the nature of the inability of the Commission of Inquiry to have access to the people concerned and to those whose testimony could help on the matter, there are limitations in identifying particular people and particular responsibility. But that doesn't prevent consideration of particular acts. For example, I may be wrong, but a very important matter in my mind is the evidence provided by UNICEF based upon hospital reports to which UNICEF has access around North Korea of the very high level, unacceptably high level, of gross malnutrition and stunting on the part of babies. 27.9% is a shocking statistic, and it's not unique in this world, but it is certainly a very grave issue. And the question would be, who is responsible, and are the decisions that lead to serious malnutrition and the unavailability of food able to be addressed to a particular organisation, individual or person? And that is something which we are certainly considering, because we have to. Our mandate requires us to examine the issue of accountability. So that is expressly stated in our mandate. So we have to address these issues, and you can be assured that we will, and at the proper time, which is when we deliver our report, those matters will be addressed in the report. Now, in relation to the rights of the people to choose their own government, I accept the force of what you've said, but the position remains that the Democratic People's Republic is a member state of the United Nations. In the Charter itself, the foundation document of the organisation, refers to, in the opening paragraphs, where it It refers to universal human rights. It refers to countries great and small. Countries large and big are organised along different lines, and different ways of expressing the will of the people is certainly available. The point I was trying to make is it would be a presumption on our part, as an organ of the United Nations, faced with a member state which is accepted as a member state of the United Nations, to take on the responsibility of addressing the notion of regime change. That is not something which comes in an inquiry which is addressed to that member state and is endeavouring to engage with it and to deal with the human rights problems that arise in the state. I understand the force of what you've said, but in the end, working within the United Nations, it's not for us to say, well, we will just disregard the fact that there is a member state that is here at the table. And although there are procedures for challenging credentials, which arose, you may remember, in the case of Cambodia itself, when the issue of whether the Democratic Kampuchea should be accepted as representing Cambodia or the new government was a very acute question for some years. There are procedures within the House to deal with that matter, but those procedures don't fall to a commission of inquiry, which has been given a particular mandate to address universal human rights deprivations in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, which is what we're doing.
Thank you. Final question, Evelyn.
Right. Speaking again from the Holy Seat with its little sign here, could you kindly elaborate on China, which seems to be key to what you're trying to accomplish? I mean, I know China doesn't want North Korea to collapse and helps keep it alive, doesn't want a flood of refugees, has seen the movie before of American troops near the Malu River. But have you discussed the possibility of not sending back every refugee who happens to get out?
Well, I think you heard what the representative of the People's Republic of China said to the Third Committee today, that there were big opportunities by engagement with North Korea to secure changes in North Korea. The hidden premise of that statement, as I respectfully understand it, is that changes are needed in North Korea, and an acceptance that that is needed is itself an important statement made publicly by the People's Republic of China. I'm not here and now going to say anything that damages the opportunity that may exist for the Commission of Inquiry to have access to China, to have access to discuss, for example, the issue of refoulement and the access of refugees surplus, and other issues. These are matters which will be better discussed if we gain that facility in China itself. We are very respectful of China. We understand where China stands on these issues, but we think it would be useful both to the Commission of Inquiry and to the United Nations family if we could have access to them, and that's what we have sought. And we are still waiting for a decision on that score. If we are given access, we will take advantage of that immediately, and we will extend our inquiry period in order to conduct further inquiries within China and discussions with the officials and scholars and institutions and others within China to whom we would then have access. But we're still waiting for a reply.
I'd like to thank our guests very much for joining us today and thank all of you for coming. Good afternoon.